Hello and welcome to the second in our series of the FRCS podcast. Today we're focusing on non-muscle invasive bladder cancer. I'm Sophia Cashman, I'm a registrar in the East of England, and as ever I'm joined by my co-host Harry.
Hi Sophia, Harry Rattan, urologist from Nottingham. How are you?
Good, how are you?
Very good. We had so much fun last time that we had to do it again, didn't we? And this time we've got company.
We've got a guest.
A guest and someone that I'm afraid has to tolerate me day in, day out, Will Green, who is a consultant with me in Nottingham. Will specializes in urothelial cancers. He is our clinical lead for the cystectomy program, has just started doing robotic cystectomies, and also does upper tract urothelial cancer. So welcome, Will.
Hi, thanks very much for having me.
This is very exciting. As with last time, we thought we'd start with a scenario and then talk through the aspects of it that we think are most likely to kind of be key points to look for in the FRCS Viva. We'll start with a 70-year-old man who has presented with hematuria. He's a smoker, but otherwise good performance status. He's already been through the hematuria pathway. He's had a flexible cystoscopy that has shown a tumour in the bladder, and that has been resected. And that came back as a multifocal G3PT1 urothelial carcinoma of the bladder. He's had a CT to check his upper tracts, which was clear. There was no evidence of any other concerns. So, Will, I guess this is something you must see regularly in your clinic. So how would you go about approaching this patient?
We do see a lot of these cases, probably see two or three in every high-risk bladder cancer clinic that we do. And I think the first thing to say is that we've got to remember what the stakes are with patients like this. I'm sure a lot of the trainees are aware of risk calculators like the RTC bladder cancer calculator. And if you put in the characteristics of this patient you just described, it says that it may have a recurrence rate of perhaps 60% at 5 years and a progression rate of 45%. So, it's in the decisions that we make with these patients are very important because they're highly likely to have recurrent and progressive disease within the next few years. And in fact, the chances of progression at 1 year are as high as 20%. So I think that's really the first point. And you have to remind yourself when you meet these patients that the decisions you take and the discussions you have in that meeting have significant ramifications down the track. So I think it is important to be frank. And sometimes we use these calculators and actually show it to the patient on the screen to give them a sort of visual representation of what their recurrence and progression rates might be. But sometimes you have to judge your patient and be a little bit more pragmatic about it.
Are there other kind of key things that you, when you get the report back and you've got the patient in clinic, there are other things you're looking on the report to kind of guide you as to how to kind of sell it, but explain the gravity of it to the patient?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like we've all seen histology reports from TURBTs, haven't we? And, the things that we're really looking for are, is it multifocal? And in our patient, we're saying that it is. The size of the tumour, and actually that's a really significant factor. Broadly speaking, is the biggest tumour under 3 centimetres or over 3 centimetres? That's an important thing that I always look for. Concomitant carcinoma in situ, if I'm honest with you, doesn't change my thinking hugely with sort of recommendations of treatment, but certainly something that we look for. But if you had to pick the most important ones, I would say number of tumours, the grade of the tumour, the stage. They're probably the three things I look for most.
And what about things like kind of slightly atypical histology, or if they report, the variants? I think in the NICE guidelines, they mention nested and micropapillary, don't they? But there's a whole host of them in the EAU ones.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's about 6 different subtypes of variant histology, and essentially they're all more nasty or nastier than a standard transitional cell carcinoma. About 1 in 5 high-grade bladder cancers has a degree of variant histology. So it's not as rare as perhaps we used to think it was. And then the interesting thing is that of people who have been found to have variant histology, about 60 to 70% of them will have T2 disease on their histology. So it's a really, really important factor to note.
Wow, that's quite a, I mean, that's a really high proportion, isn't it? So yeah, it essentially, is. If we see atypical histology, then the alarm bells should be ringing slightly. Absolutely. Is that right?
So yeah. You need to be treating these patients with a lot of caution. And the other thing, of course, is that the reporting of variant histology is only really happening in the last 2 or 3 years. And then, of course, you know, that means that there may be a degree of understaging patients that has been going on historically, and hopefully we'll see that starts to phase out as people become more aware of it.
I mean, I don't know if you mentioned performance status in your vignette, Sophia, but I guess that's really important to you as well, Will, isn't it, when you eyeball the patient?
Absolutely. I mean, I think most patients who can get to clinic are probably fit enough for a TURBT or a re-resection. I mean, I suppose by definition in our case, they must have been fit for a TURBT, but there's no doubt that you've got half an eye on the future. And when you see the patient in clinic, one of the possible treatments you might offer them in the future would be an upfront cystectomy. And that's a highly comorbid operation. And, you know, patients have to be pretty fit to be put through that. So considerations about fitness do need to be taken early, because you don't want to be offering something like a cystectomy as a possible treatment option to someone who's clearly never going to be fit for it.
Okay. So you kind of mentioned re-resection. That's that magic word that we're all aware of. So what's the rationale for re-resection in a case like this?
Well, I mean, I think fundamentally there's two principles. One is that you want to know that you are correct in your assessment of what the histology has been found to be, because the decisions you're now going to take or subsequently take are so important, they really need to be made with accurate information. So that's probably principle number one. But the second is that you have to understand that, or we have to understand that, there is huge variation in resection quality throughout the country and throughout, you know, the Western world. There's a lot of evidence to say that residual disease can be found in between 15% of patients who've had TURBTs for a single tumor, through to perhaps 45% if they've had multifocal tumors found on their initial TURBT. There's other studies that show people have found persistent high-grade disease in up to 50% of tumors that have previously been resected. So, you know, it depends on the studies that you look at. But if you're looking at a range of perhaps 15% to 50% residual disease after initial TURBT, there's a large number of patients who could potentially be understaged because of that. So broadly speaking, you know, you have to have a figure in your head that you can use to explain that situation to a patient. So I say about 1 in 3 patients will have residual cancer on a re-resection if they've previously been found to have high-grade disease.
Actually, it's quite a high amount, isn't it? I think the EAU mentioned the Cumberbatch paper from 2018, but that was just for T1, wasn't it?
Yeah, so in Cumberbatch found in T1 about 50% of patients had persistent cancer on re-resection. The main study that looked at TA as well, I think, was Browsey. Mm-hmm. And Browsey found, Browsey was able to separate down to tumors which were unifocal and tumors which were multifocal, and that hugely affected the persistence of cancer on re-resection.
So would you offer a re-resection to all of the high-grade patients you see?
I do. I'm aware there's variation in sort of practice throughout the UK, and I'm aware of centres that with TA disease don't always offer a re-resection. In our practice, we do. So anyone with high-grade pathology gets a re-resection.
Yeah, because I think there is not a discrepancy, but the NICE guidelines say offer if high-risk within 6 weeks, and EAU say offer obviously if no muscle, but I think they say T1, don't they?
I think so. Yeah. So you're quite right. So they don't all have exactly the same guidance, and I think you've just got to pick what you're comfortable with. And I've certainly seen patients with high grade TA that have been found to have persistent cancer on re-resections.
So assuming you are going to re-resect, is there anything specifically you're looking at other than residual disease and looking for any understaging? Is there anything else you'd be looking at a re-resection?
I think if you are looking at the patient and thinking, you know, they've got very high risk disease, they're fit, they may very well be going for a cystectomy. I might very well ask for specific bladder neck biopsies. Just to make sure that that area is clear. It just allows for discussions about how you might reconstruct them. I think that would be quite a sensible thing to ask for. But other than that, fundamentally, I want to know, is there persistent cancer? If there is it the same stage as the initial resection, or is it a higher stage? That information really, combined with your initial histology, is what's going to determine what you offer the patient down the track.
Okay, so Will, a common scenario then is that they've had their re-resection and the histologist come back as just showing scar tissue, no active cancer. You're confident in your original histology. How do you proceed in this scenario?
So then we've got a patient who's got multifocal T1 disease, but it's been fully cleared on the initial resection by the sounds of it. So I guess fundamentally, it would be making an assessment of the patient's fitness status. Of course, they would have had to have been through an MDT discussion, but broadly speaking, the MDT outcome is going to offer either BCG, intravesical therapy, or a primary cystectomy. High-grade T1 with a clear re-resection, I don't think it's unreasonable to offer a BCG. It's also reasonable to offer a primary cystectomy, and I think the things that might tip the scale would be age of the patient, so particularly young patient, you know, if you're thinking they've got 30 or 40 more years of life expectancy, are they really going to go all that time with BCG alone? Hard to say. You may say, even though the effect on quality of life is very significant with an upfront cystectomy, perhaps given its sort of gold standard from a cancer control point of view, it might be a more sensible approach. And on the other end of the scale, if you've got someone who's in their, I don't know, late 70s, early 80s with the same histology, you might say, well, putting them through a cystectomy is highly likely to cause them a lot of comorbidity, and perhaps it would be a more sensible and safe option to give them a trial of BCG first.
Great. So should we talk through them both in a little bit of detail? Assuming, as we said, you know, muscle clear, no concerns for this patient, and he opts for BCG, yeah. How would you explain it to him?
Well, I sort of tend to explain that BCG is essentially a similar medication to that that's given to children to prevent tuberculosis. And often that immediately brings a bit of familiarity with the patient, and they can suddenly picture it and understand its sort of context. And then I sort of explain that a lot of people who've had the BCG vaccine for TB have a scar on their arm. And I explain that the scar is not really because of the injection they've had. It's actually your body's reaction to the injection. And you get an immune response which causes that scar tissue. And I explain that it's a similar process in the bladder. So I talk about it in that sort of language. And then we talk about potentially some of the risks that can happen with BCG, and also what is the benefit. And we all know that there is no doubt that its effects are not perfect, and while I think we'd all agree it does have a reasonable impact on recurrence rates, its impact on progression is less clear. These sort of factors are quite difficult to discuss with patients, because explaining the difference between recurrence and progression is a tricky concept.
Just to expand on that then, what is the evidence regarding reduction in progression and recurrence then?
So, I mean, if we start with recurrence, you know, there's been a lot of work in over 20 years looking at it. And I suppose the big names in the evidence in that field are Sylvester, Lamb and Shelley. Sylvester's meta-analysis in the early 2000s, I think it was, showed about a 30% relative risk reduction in recurrence rates. Lamb, around the same time, demonstrated that that benefit only really takes place if you have a maintenance course after the induction course. There have been two or three other big studies over the next 10 years, with Malmstrong in 2009 demonstrating a very similar relative risk reduction in recurrence rates. I think it's very safe to say to a patient that if you were to take a course of BCG, including induction and maintenance, you'd probably reduce the chances of your cancer coming back by about 30%. And that's how I explain it. I think that is a reasonable summary of how it works with regard to recurrence.
You mentioned LAM, didn't you?
Yeah.
LAM, just to segue slightly, LAM is the one who came up with the protocol that most of us follow. Do you follow the traditional LAM?
Yeah, broadly speaking. I mean, that's the jury's out a little bit about that. So historically, and when I was Harry's registrar, we would have given 3 years of maintenance and, you'd have your induction course and 3 subsequent years. Not long after that, it became apparent that a third year is probably not adding a great deal to the patient's outcomes. So it's been dropped to 2 years. And in fact, more recently, it becomes apparent that the first year of maintenance is the vast majority of benefit to the patient. And if you look at regimens that the different trusts are using throughout the country, I think there is a relatively swift movement to 1 year of maintenance, although that may be more as a response to the BCG shortage, of course.
I was just going to say, is that just a pragmatic thing? Because, hey-ho, you turn your back and it runs out, doesn't it? So
absolutely true. Although I have to say, in our experience, we've managed to offer BCG for the time we've wanted to offer it for. While it's been tight, we've never actually run out. So our decision currently is 2 years of maintenance, but there is no doubt that the vast majority is in the first year of maintenance. And so these decisions are a balance of risk and benefit, and people do get side effects from BCG. And so if you think that the second year of maintenance is not offering a great deal of benefit or causing a lot of side effects and symptoms, there may be an argument to not offer the second year. And actually, if a patient comes to see me and they've had a full year of maintenance and now they're starting to get really bad side effects, I'm quite comfortable to stop it at that point.
And I think, again, being pragmatic, I think from Lamb's paper, it's one of these few numbers I remember from my FRCS days long, long ago as they were. I think only 17% of his cohort made it to the 27th installation, didn't they?
So, absolutely. So
we've got a very clear idea about the recurrence rate, but progression is perhaps the more important and interesting thing. So what's the impact of BCG on progression rate?
The headline message is the jury's out. There are, again,
I thought it was just stone surgeons that didn't have any evidence. I thought you guys had got it all stitched up.
We don't like to admit it. I mean, again, Sylvester did a big meta-analysis in the early 2000s, which did apparently show a reduction in progression rates. So I think in a BCG-treated group, the progression rates over the follow-up period was about 10%. And in the TURBT-only group, it was about 14%. So there was a reduction, but it's not been subsequently shown. There was a Cochrane review which didn't demonstrate the same benefit. And then again, Marmstrong looked at progression and he didn't show the same benefit. Looking at a variety of the papers on it, I think on balance, BCG probably does improve progression, but there are issues that are hard to surmount. So lack of consistency on length of maintenance when you look at the studies makes it quite hard to analyze them. And another problem is that a lot of the control groups are not particularly well matched. There probably is a benefit, but the studies out there are not quite sufficient to prove it. And whether or not we'll get to that stage is hard to say. There are no primary trials of BCG versus no treatment taking place at the moment that I'm aware of.
Do you have kind of like a headline figure you give them as to what the likely long-term outcome with BCG is?
Yeah. I mean, again, as with all things, you can read different figures in different journals and different papers. But broadly speaking, I think it's reasonable to say that about 40% of patients who you start on BCG will fail at some point and then go on to need further treatment.
We've talked about BCG. Should we talk slightly about cystectomy and what the benefit of an upfront cystectomy is? I know you mentioned the risk of understaging, and I think a lot of the evidence is from the pathology from cystectomies, isn't it, after having had it for high-risk disease.
There's no doubt in my mind that if you want to control high-grade bladder cancer, cystectomy is the gold standard. I think if you were to see someone like the patient in our scenario here, if you were to offer them an upfront cystectomy early with G3, T1 disease, with nothing on the re-resection, you'd confidently offer them a cure rate of perhaps 80%. And I think that's significantly higher than any other treatment. So TURBT alone or TURBT and subsequent BCG therapy. So if it wasn't something that caused such an effect on a patient's quality of life, and there's no doubt that it does, everyone should get a cystectomy. But of course, in reality, telling someone who's in the prime of their life, who may have a partner, may have children, may have a busy job, that they need an operation that may keep them in hospital for a week, may take 3 months to recover from, may leave them with a permanent stoma or some form of urinary reconstruction, it's not realistic to expect everyone to go for that.
Mm. What do you give a vague ballpark about the morbidity and mortality for cystectomy? Because I vaguely remember something about a third of people have a major morbidity and the mortality of about 2-3%. Is that right?
Yeah, so absolutely right. With a major complication or a significant complication, I think it's fair to say about 30%. That's
a big undertaking, isn't it?
It is. And the problem is a lot of those complications are very difficult to manage and can leave patients with lifelong problems. You know, ureteral stricture is a big issue because you either leave a patient with stents in or nephrostomies in, or perhaps they need revision surgery of their conduit. These are hugely critical issues that can go wrong. And, you know, and that's just one aspect or one thing that comes to mind straight away. If you were to give a rectal injury to a patient, which probably has a risk of about 1 in 150, that can be life-changing. You know, they could end up with a colostomy as well as a urostomy. If you start just looking at patients that have done really well, the effect on their life is significant. You know, erectile dysfunction is highly likely to occur. You know, we are now switching over to robotic cystectomy, so nerve spare is increasingly becoming an option. But there's no doubt that sexual function, both in males and females after a cystectomy, is markedly impaired.
Just a couple of questions about cystectomy in these patients, Will. So obviously we're talking about an upfront primary cystectomy, but I guess the other role for it is in patients who have failed BCG therapy. Yep. Do you find that it's a much harder operation in patients who've already had BCG?
No, I don't actually. Patients who have BCG, you can sometimes find it's a little bit more sticky. Lymph nodes, I would say, are a bit more tricky to get out, but not markedly so. I think there's the odd patient where it's very difficult, perhaps if they've had a perforation during the TURBT, and often patients are perforated and it's not recognized, and then you can sort of see where it's taken place, and you can see that there's a very well demarcated sticky area in the pelvis. But no, I don't find patients
But that's with BCG more due to the TURBT, presumably,
yeah,
rather than the BCG.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So BCG alone doesn't really worry me. Salvage cystectomies worry me. You know, people who've had radiotherapy or a prostatectomy before.
Oh, that's, sure.
Another level.
BCG failures, I mean, how do they do after cystectomy? Do they fare as well as the upfront cystectomies, or is their outcome worse?
I think that their outcome is slightly worse, unfortunately, and there are papers out there that do show that. So that's something that you really do have to factor in the counselling about BCG. And I always explain to patients that in those patients where the cancer returns while they're on BCG, the majority of patients will have the cancer come back in the bladder and still remain a surgical candidate. But there will be a small number of patients who come back. They have a recurrence identified and then are restaged and unfortunately have disseminated disease and are not suitable for surgery. That group of patients have essentially missed a curative operation which could have taken place 2 years before.
Mm, and so when we talk about these BCG failures then, I mean, clearly, you know, the metastatic disease is the worst end of the spectrum, but you know, if they do have recurrent disease then and have failed BCG and they're really keen not to have cystectomy, are there any other options for them?
There are. They're not good options, but there are options. So a proportion of patients will ask to have reinduction BCG. I personally don't think it works very well at all. There are some older studies that perhaps a third of those patients respond to a new induction course. I've not seen it. My impression is that almost everyone we've put through reinduction BCG has gone on to recur again. A second option would be to think about an intravesical treatment using sort of an adjunct technology. So something like heated mitomycin would be something that we would consider, and certainly sent a few patients for that with mixed results. By definition, I think someone who has had BCG and had a cancer return, they've got a significant cancer. And I think they're going to do poorly unless they are fit for a cystectomy. And obviously you've got a group of patients who simply aren't fit and never will be. And then you have a group of patients who choose not to have a cystectomy for one reason or another.
But to be clear, there's no role for systemic chemotherapy in these patients then?
If you're talking about patients who've had BCG failure and been found to have a recurrence in the bladder.
So but non-metastatic.
Non-metastatic, then no, not really. Not without perhaps inclusion in a trial, but that certainly wouldn't be standard practice.
I think we've covered a lot of ground there, Will. Very complex and nuanced topic, isn't it? And I know you have a very hard job in your Thursday afternoon clinic dealing with these very unfortunate patients, a lot of whom have got bad disease. But you know, as well as being our kind of robotic cystectomy supremo, you're also our lead for R&D, and you've been involved in quite a few innovative bladder cancer trials. I mean, what's really exciting for you that's on the horizon as far as treatment of non-muscle invasive high-risk bladder cancer goes?
It's an evolving field, and it's increasing very rapidly. There's a lot of trials just in setup and a few that have started, but overwhelmingly I think the trials are focusing on immunotherapy and immunomodulation of bladder cancer. There are trials that are currently running, which are more practical day-to-day trials, which is the one that we're involved with, which is BCG mitomycin, which is looking at combined BCG mitomycin therapy given in a different regimen to previous studies and day-to-day practice. And that's almost finished recruiting. So that's 500 patients worldwide. And I think we're about 470 patients now. But I think that is going to be quite an interesting study looking at the practical day-to-day use of medications that the NHS has on its books and can and utilize very quickly. So actually, I think that will be quite interesting to see the results of that, which we'll hopefully have in the next couple of years. There's no doubt that the more extreme immune trials are likely to be the ones which show the biggest improvements. So there are various ones that I've looked at, and there are trials looking at intravesical immune therapy, so washing out of the bladder in a similar way to mitomycin and BCG. There's a couple of studies going on in California at the moment, another one in Australia looking at these, and I think they're recruiting small numbers. These are sort of proof of concept trials with 50 or 60 recruits in each one. And then there are other trials, which again are very small, but looking at directly injecting immunotherapy drugs into TURBT specimens before you actually resect them. They're quite interesting. So there's been some studies where they've done this in small groups of patients. And so the patient has a tumor identified. They're put on a list for a TURBT, and before they have the resection, they have the immune drug injected. And then they have the resection. In the trial study, I think they went on to have cystectomy. And then they looked at the proportion and makeup of the immune cells within the specimens on cystectomy. And there was a very, very significant rise in the amount and proportion of immune cells seen. So this is really, again, a proof of concept to see if whether patients could tolerate having an immune drug injected directly into a tumor without too many side effects. So this is the way things are going. And I think 5 or 10 years' time, we're going to perhaps see more widespread use of that in non-muscle invasive bladder cancer.
Fascinating stuff.
Great. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to go through all that with us. I think that was immensely helpful. And I've certainly learned stuff.
Will, we've got to mention Phil, haven't we? Otherwise, he's going to get really upset. He will. He will on the podcast.
He's my
tell us about Phil.
So Phil is, I don't know whether this will ever get published. Phil is my consultant colleague, Phil Goodall. And so Phil and I have a shared practice, really. So we do the same sort of job plan, share our robot cystectomies and run very similar cancer clinics. So I wouldn't be able to do any of it without Phil, as much as I wouldn't want to admit it.
Well, yes, we'll decide whether we're going to publish that bit or
yeah,
or
you're a little
thank you so much again. Does that wrap this particular episode up, Sophia? I think so.
Yeah, I think so. And then in the future, we'll go on to look at the more aggressive muscle invasive bladder cancer and the options for reconstruction in more detail.
Yeah, we'll get into the weeds of cystectomies and consent.
Sounds
and
great.
Complications.
We'll have you doing cystectomy before you know it, Harry.
I won't formulate an answer to that on air, Will, but thanks again. Brilliant.